You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 14th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City as the Rolling Jubilee, the Strike Debt, gains some momentum. We will be talking to David Graeber, author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years, on today's program. Also on today's program, President Obama presents the opening salvo in the 2013 budget negotiations, meets with progressive leaders yesterday, business leaders today. I'm still nervous. Also, perhaps of greater concern, global warming. Italy, with massive floods. And meanwhile, in Europe, massive strikes. In Spain and Portugal today, anti-austerity strikes. Also, some news on the Walmart strikes that have been taking place over the past several months and are gearing up for Black Friday. Also, building on a story we mentioned yesterday, Austin looking to secede from the secessionists. And let's start off with this. Some good news, in my estimation. Nancy Pelosi has announced that she will stay on as the Democratic leader in the House, or the minority leader, as is the case. The Democrats are in the minority. She told a packed caucus meeting on Wednesday, that is today, ladies and gentlemen. That's how quickly we're getting the news now with the internet, that if Steve Israel, which is not as exciting to me, was willing to head up the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, not as exciting to me because he's, I don't know if he's specifically a blue dog, but he is certainly of that ilk. If he is willing to head up the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee again, she will happily retain her spot as the leader of the Democratic Caucus. I wouldn't get too hung up on her making that condition. He has agreed to do so, is my understanding, but also it makes sense from her perspective to protect her right flank, as it were. But I am both heartened by this and relieved, because if it wasn't going to be Nancy Pelosi, it may have been Steny Hoyer, and that's a rather depressing thought. So she will stay on as House Minority Leader, and one can only hope that her posturing on issues like specifically on Simpson-Bowles or Bowles-Simpson or whatever that letter by those two old coots who hate Social Security and Medicare wrote to the president. I'm anticipating she's going to fight pretty hard to protect Medicare and Social Security, which I think is going to be absolutely necessary if it is going to remain unscathed following the big fiscal negotiations. Chris Hayes made a good point on his program this past weekend that this notion of a fiscal cliff and the idea of debt reduction are completely at odds with each other. We're worried about the fiscal cliff because it's going to contract the deficit. Do you understand? The fiscal cliff will contract the deficit. It will also contract the economy. It is crucial that you understand the reason why we have a deficit larger than we had in 2007, say. It's because of the recession. Revenues went down because economic activity went down. It increased the deficit. The fact that the deficit increased was the only thing that kept us from going into a depression. Government spending by borrowing. And really, I mean, now I know this is going to upset our second half show, I Am or Bush and Chains, but we could also just continue to print money. I know, them are fighting words. I did an interview with Bill Black for Ring of Fire yesterday, which we will play next week. But he told me of something that I had not heard before, which was that if you send cash in to the IRS to pay your taxes, they shred it. And they just put it on a line item. It just becomes virtual. That's what happens when you have a sovereign currency and you can print your own money. The actual money itself is not terribly relevant. While you digest that, I will also tell you that independent Angus King, nay Khan, from Maine, as expected, said he would join the Democratic caucus, saying that, quote, affiliating with the majority makes sense, which I guess is easier than saying, like, I don't want to be with those bat crap Republicans for a guy who wants to run as an independent in Maine. Simply say, if I'm caucusing with the majority, then I will be able to bring home more goodies to the state, which is the reason why we have government, which is and the only thing that we're really fighting about at the end of the day is not whether or not government provides goodies to people. The real argument is to whom and how much. So the idea that people vote, the only reason why President Obama voted is because his voters want stuff from government. No. The only reason why people vote, period, is because they want stuff from government. The question is, who wants what? And in this country, it generally breaks down on economic class lines. And then the people with all that extra money spend it on campaigns to argue that anybody else who wants something from government is a moocher. Whereas they're just job creators. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to author David Graeber right after this. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program David Graeber. He is the author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years, as well as being a reader in the Department of Anthropology, Goldsmiths, University of London. Welcome back to the program, David.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I want to talk about this rolling jubilee, but I mean, first, I just want to... I'm not going to do your book justice by encapsulating it so briefly, but you in your book you basically make the argument that our perception of debt and currency, the story that we've basically been told by economics, does not jibe with the reality of human history. And in fact, the anthropological the anthropological story of debt is that first there was debt, then there was currency, and then the idea of barter in exchange of like goods for in lieu of currency only happened when certain currencies failed over history. And
yeah, it's like in Russia where if you have money and it goes away, you got to do something, so you carry on as if you had money.
And this informs our perception of debt and the sort of the morality that is associated with debt.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely critical because the question is, why are we telling this story? You know, once upon a time, people used to use barter and that became inconvenient, so they had to invent money. We all know this story, and anthropologists have been pointing out for almost 200 years now that this isn't true. There's no place. I mean, we can find endless varieties of economic arrangements in the world, but no place where people are sitting around saying, tell you what, I'll give you 2 chickens for that cow. So the story serves a purpose, and it serves a purpose of creating a certain image of what people are like, that we don't necessarily have any real relations with each other. That's not what we're really thinking about. We're just thinking about stuff and how to get the most of it for ourselves. And it also creates a certain way of thinking about debt, that originally there is no debt. Nobody owes anything to anybody. But if you look at what actually happens, you know, everybody's kind of in debt to each other in a million different ways. You can't really put a number on it. And gradually they figure out how to put a number on some of it. And that's the real story of money.
And how does that inform the sort of the morality that has come up around debt? Because, you know, the story that we're being told about debt is there's nothing more immoral you can do than to not pay your debts.
I know, it's fascinating. And one of the reasons why is because debt is basically a promise. It's a promise to pay a certain amount of money at a certain terms. Promises, you know, are sacred things. So most of us feel that a promise is sacred. Our society is really nothing more than a set of promises we make to each other, if you think about it. However, why is it that we think of a promise that's in money as being somehow more sacred? So that, you know, politicians all the time make promises and we just assume they're going to break them. Why did they break them? Usually the excuse is, well, we have to pay our debts. Why is a promise that a state makes to some banker to pay at a certain rate of interest considered sacred, but a promise to provide free education is not? How did we get there? And my conclusion, it's a long story how it happened, is that, you know, a debt is a very certain type of promise. It's a promise that's been corrupted by math and violence, the sort of combination of the two. Thus, it becomes impersonal and enforceable by governments. And if you look at history, if there's a promise between equals, if there's a debt between poor people or between rich people, yeah, sure, it can always be renegotiated. It's just like any other promise. It's only when it's the poor people or to the rich people that somehow it becomes absolutely sacred. Well, that tells you something.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because, you know, I mean, particularly in light of this, it's completely unrelated, but this David Petraeus scandal, you know, the idea that people can get married, which is a promise to each other, right?
Sure.
And that people can be forgiving. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from all the other sort of tawdry aspects of it, you know, a lot of people say, like, look, you know, people fall in and out of love. These are relationships that they have. They break their promises to each other. And that, in some way, can be forgiven. And that it's that same concept, right? They both have entered the marriage together. They both are considered sort of in the same class. They both have entered this sort of same, I guess, status of being married to each other. And we can sort of forgive that debt. But the idea that in some way he was a scofflaw or something that wouldn't have paid his bills, that would have been the crime of the century in some ways.
Yeah, depending on who they were owed to. Because, of course, like, you know, if you're AIG or you're Citigroup, well, then you can, you know. That's the interesting thing. Nobody talks about those guys as being like evil if they try to screw their workers out of their pensions or even Social Security. I mean, that's just a promise, and they're trying to abrogate that one all the time. So that's why it's like, you know, in fact, it's a debt. So when it's like debts owed by powerful people to powerless ones, it's not a totally different story. We don't talk about it as a sacred thing at all. It's a very interesting the way the rhetoric works.
Yeah, and so and with that sort of, I guess, predicate, let's talk about strike debt and this rolling jubilee. How did where did this you know, strike debt is a, I guess, an offshoot of Occupy or an extension.
Yeah, it's part of Occupy. It's a project within Occupy, I guess, would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, talk about this because I mean, I've read Sean McAlpin's, mm-hmm. I guess, history or story of strike debt, how it came out of meetings that were taking place after people were evicted from Liberty Square.
Yeah.
And just give us a sense of that, because he speaks about debt as being at the heart of a lot of the issues that Occupy was.
It's absolutely true.
All right, well, yeah. Expand on that for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I actually, myself, I'm the obvious person to get involved in this since I've just written a book on debt and I was involved in Occupy. And I tried to hold back at first because, you know, you don't want to use a social movement to advertise your book or to impose your ideas on a social movement. So, but debt kept cropping up over and over again, whatever we did. Even at the very beginning of Zuccotti Park, when we put out the call, we weren't really sure who was going to show up. And for the most part, everybody showed up at that very first day or two. You know, it gradually became much more diverse. But the very first people who showed up were basically people who had been either were or had recently been students and were swamped in student loan debt. And, you know, they had a very, very simple story, you know, which was like, I was one of the good kids. I studied hard. I you know, did what I was told. I borrowed money to go to school. And, you know, here I am, $50,000 in debt. And the guys who lent me the money, they didn't play by the rules. They sank the world economy, but they got bailed out. Now I'm going to spend the rest of my life being told I'm a deadbeat because, you know, I can't pay my loans to them. So that debt theme was there from the very beginning. The interesting thing, and this shows you a lot about what's happening in American society, is, you know, in 20 years ago, maybe even 10, the plight of a indebted college graduate is not going to, like, speak to the hearts of a transit worker. But those guys totally identified with us. It was very interesting. The unions came through in this really strong way and realized that, you know, debt is a much broader issue. And an issue of a lot more appeal because the working poor and people with student loan debts are the guys who really can't get out after 2008. There's a sort of confluence of interest around it. And then after the evictions, well, we held a series of assemblies on different themes. We'll do one on climate change. We'll do one on this. So we talk about stop and frisk. And, you know, there was interest in all of these, but the one on debt was huge. Incredible numbers of people showed up. So we realized that, all right, this is what people seem to want to talk about. And gradually we started focusing more and more on the issue.
One of the things that he writes is that he writes that it was clearly understood the vast majority of the issues faced in a capitalist neoliberal world are funded by debt. He's talking about the projects that rape our planet, the projects that destroy neighborhoods. And then the other side of that is the implications of debt on individuals. But it debt seems to permeate all of these. Maybe it's hard to reduce it all down to one sort of one notion, but it plays a role
it's
in
the
all
element
of these problems.
Of all of them, yeah.
And I guess it allows also, I mean, it is debt which allows sort of constant expansion and fuels.
Exactly. Let me talk about that for a second. Because one thing that startled me was that the way they legalized debt, because, you know, it had been illegal through all medieval history, was to say, well, if you let somebody have your money, there's a penalty for not returning it because you would have been making money on it. But the assumption is that all money grows at 5%, and that was the first legal interest rate. And it's the same interest rate, I mean, the same rate at which economies are kind of supposed to grow in order to be healthy. We still have this idea, you know. So there's an assumption that money is supposed to grow, value is supposed to expand, and debt is the major way of fueling that by essentially making people work more and more. And now we've got the situation where growth rates have gone down, but the debt keeps going up because we're still promising each other to grow at the same rate as we used to, even though it's basically physically impossible. This is why I say that, like, debt is actually – the debt crisis and the ecological crisis are in a certain way the same thing. We keep trying to accelerate and grow in a situation where that's completely not viable. The economic system – capitalism itself is based on this need to continually grow that just can't work anymore. As a result – we just keep promising ourselves to do it even more next year because we can't now.
I mean, it's in some ways, I mean, the debt was obfuscating the stagnation of growth of workers' pay over the past 30 years or so in this country, whether it was whether it was sort of easy.
It compensates it and also drives it along because – occasionally people like Greenspan would let go on this and actually admit it. The idea of getting everybody a mortgage, of getting everybody in debt, was itself a way of making sure that people don't strike. Because if you're a worker and you've got a mortgage, you can't very well strike for very long. Because you'll get kicked out of your house. And all they thought about all this when they did these policies, intentionally trying to get everybody more and more into debt. So, you know, the less people strike, the number of strikes in America got way down, the less wages grow, and the more indebted people become.
And this, of course, is the same with the real estate bubble. Again, was just about a matter of basically a way of getting of we call it easy credit, but it's really what we're talking about is easy debt. And this is the same thing that we're doing with the planet in many respects, is sort of expending resources that really should be expended 50 to 75 years out as opposed to today. And we're going to find out when we get there that we're not going to have those resources.
Exactly. It's insane. I mean, nothing could be more irrational than like doing this breakneck expansion at this point. But that's what our entire financial system is urging us to do. That's why I said, Occupy doesn't have specific demands, but I think I proposed at one point, if we were going to have one, I'd say, all right, debt cancellation followed by 4-hour day. You know, because it's debt that's making everybody work more and more. We need to be working less. This insane over-dedication to work is destroying the planet.
And so that takes us to this rolling jubilee. How does this work and what is it ultimately supposed to do?
Well, obviously we can't really forgive everybody's debt in America. One out of every 7 Americans is being pursued by a collection agency at this point. But what we realize when we're trying to do this campaign is that there are people who are already actually engaged in civil disobedience against this financial system where government and finance collude with each other. Basically, the banks bribe the politicians to create rules that will keep everybody in debt. Well, what's financial disobedience? What's civil disobedience against that system? It's just not paying. Millions and millions and millions of people are not paying. But how do you organize them? Well, you can't because they're all in hiding. You know, they can't talk to each other. They're ashamed. By the very definition, they can't identify themselves publicly. We like to put it like there's this invisible army of millions of defaulters. who are practicing civil disobedience, but what do we do to help them? We realize, well, this is something we can do. It's like a jubilee in the sense of debt forgiveness. Obviously, we can't do it all at once. But we realize that the way debt collection works is that, say, your child is sick, you take them to a hospital, you have crappy insurance or no insurance, you end up with a $10,000 bill, you can't pay it. Or you don't. That's ridiculous. They'll send that to a debt collector in 6 months. But what they do is they sell it to them for 5 cents on the dollar, even less sometimes, 4 cents. And then the debt collector takes it and chases you down. Now, the interesting thing is that it shows that they're more than willing to write off this stuff at 90-95%. They're just not willing to write it off to you. To you, they're going to try to collect the whole thing. So we realize, well, we can just buy it. There's no legal reason anybody can't buy this debt. You can't tell whose it is, obviously, or then people would buy their own. But you can say, you know, give me medical debt in Hoboken. I want $5 million. And you can do it. And once you own it, you can do whatever you like with it. So you can just cancel it. So that's what we're doing.
Okay. So now there's a couple of things I want to start with just this notion of defaulters are practicing civil disobedience. And let me play the devil's advocate here. It's one thing when we talk about medical costs, but, you know, money is fungible. You know, why do those people have a TV? granted, a TV is going to cost $200. Right. But, I mean, the idea of talk about this is where the morality comes back into it, where it's just so hard for people to accept the notion of defaulters as practicing civil disobedience, as opposed to just being, a shoe buying spendthrift. I mean, I say this because
But the thing is, like, there's almost no case. Is that the case? I'm sure there are people out there who go crazy, max out their credit cards, and don't pay. They're mostly 17 years old, and their parents eventually pay, or pay some of it. In fact, they're the favored people for credit cards to go after because they want to go after college students because they think they're the most likely to buy a lot of shoes, then like hide the thing so that interest accrues and not talk about it for a year, and then call their parents and their parents will pay. So there is that. Those are hardly the people what we're going to be targeting. But like even so, we want to talk about morality here. Yeah, somebody's 17 years old. Their brain isn't even fully formed in certain ways. This is really child abuse, and it's the banks that are seeking these guys out who are doing it. So why is it nobody talks about the morality of intentionally targeting people like that of milking their parents? I mean, that's, so even when you are talking about spendthrift people, it's really the credit cards, which seem to be more moral appropriate as far as I'm concerned. But that's a tiny proportion of the people in debt. I mean, 74% of families in America are in debt.
It's fascinating to me because, you know, I have a friend of mine who is a regular listener of this program who is who buys corporate debt and then buys the corporate debt and then resells it essentially in bankruptcy, and who is who still talks about debt. And this is not someone who is really terribly corporate himself or would consider himself very left leaning. But this notion of debt being, the idea that debt can be illegitimate is such an anathema to the way that we have all been raised, it seems to me.
Exactly. I have to run soon, but that's a good note to end on because it's really important. Why is it that the mafia, for example, always talk in terms of debt? Why is it the conquering armies will always like figure out a way to make everybody they conquer indebted to them? It's because debt is the most effective way ever created to take a relation of violent inequality and to make it seem like it's the victim who's to blame. You know, people have known this for thousands of years. You show up, you conquer people, you say, okay, you guys owe me your lives because, you know, I didn't kill you. I could have. I'm going to charge for that, of course, but you know, I'm a nice guy to let you off the hook for the first few months, but after that I expect prompt payment. You know, suddenly it's the victims who are running around feeling inadequate, feeling like they're done something wrong. And that's always been the case. You frame, that's why you see this weird situation where debts between rich people, oh, come on, they made like trillions of dollars worth of debt disappear when American Insurance Group was in trouble, or one of these big institutions. Nobody had a moral crisis. Well, I mean, they thought it shouldn't happen, but it's not like these same guys were preaching to us about our responsibility to pay for our medical debt that we never should have incurred anywhere anyway, because in every civilized country, these things are covered. Those guys never like made a big thing about how wrong it was to like make all that debt disappear. I mean, the entire way our financial system works right now is basically giving money to banks. That's not a problem. And it's been institutionalized because, oh, I could go into how it happens. But, you know, yet when you're poor, all of a sudden it's a moral thing. You have to pay every penny.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I know you have to run. Can I ask you just one more quick question on the mechanics?
Sure.
This idea that, okay, I can go as a third party and buy this debt, medical debt from Hoboken. I think even on a website somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where the website is.
Yeah, a lot of it's on a website, man.
And then go out and try and, you know, collect that debt, or I guess sell it to even a fourth party at that point if I wanted to. But I cannot go and buy my own debt. Or the idea that in some way to not collect on this debt is problematic. Explain to us why. Because that some way attacks the moral foundation of this. That it creates a so-called moral hazard. Explain that for just a sec.
Well, I mean, there's moral hazard on both sides, right? But I think that, yes, they don't want you to be able to buy your own debt. They're willing to forgive it, but they don't want to set a precedent. Because, you know, if you knew, they figure if you knew they could forgive it, you would be even less inclined to pay. But there's also, like, that idea that there's something terribly wrong with you, that is the strongest weapon they have. They just don't want to give that up. And this is the fascinating thing. They know that they have to forgive debt. They know this doesn't work. They know that, like, the economy is, like, the basic reason that the economy hasn't been recovering is nobody has any money. Just if they get any, they're trying to liquidate their debt with it rather than buying things, which actually stimulate the economy. They know that from an economic perspective, none of this makes sense. It's a feudal system of extraction, right? Nobody quite knows, but I think the average American household is paying something like 16% of its income in interest fees alone. So you put together the interest fees, the penalties, the various different ways they take money from you directly, probably 20%. That's amazing. That's like 20% of your income being taken directly by Wall Street. So when they talk about financialization of capital, that's what they're really talking about. They're not talking about people like making up pieces of paper and inventing money out of thin air. They want you to think that's what it is. But no, they're just taking your money. And how are they doing it? They're doing that because they bribe politicians to set up laws that make it inevitable that you have to do this. They're constantly making up new ones. They'll say, oh, to be a pharmacist, you have to have this certificate. And the only way to get the certificate is to, like, go back to adult education where they have, like, these extravagant loans that you have to take. But then, like, the government administers those loans and makes sure you can't get out of them in bankruptcy. So, I mean, all of these laws are put together by financial interests to make sure that they take a larger and larger share of your salary. Yet, somehow, that is not considered immoral. But the fact that if you get trapped into that situation and you say, to hell of it, I'm going to spend this money on my kid's education, you're a bad person.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. And we'll talk more about this rolling jubilee. But I appreciate you taking the time. I know you were in a rush. And so thanks for spending
time. Yeah, I'm totally late. I'm so everyone.
Thank you, Dave. All right. Appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, folks. And just I want to just give you some of the details before we go into the better half of the program. This Thursday at Le Poisson Rouge, for those of you who don't speak French, is the red fish in Manhattan. The Rolling Jubilee is holding a fundraiser. Now, apparently it's sold out. So not terribly helpful for you folks, other than to know that it's going on. The Rolling Jubilee, we'll put a link up on the site. They've already raised $129,000, which will be enough to buy $2.5 million worth of defaulted loans. There are a lot of sort of mechanical issues that we didn't have a chance to get into with David that I'm hoping to talk to someone over the next week or so, maybe after Thanksgiving, as to what's involved with this. Issues like if you buy up someone's debt and then relieve them of that debt by sending a certificate, essentially, which is what the plan here, by saying that we're not going to collect on this debt. We're basically giving you the money that you owe back to you. You, as that person whose debt has been relieved, are you liable for that in terms of taxes? Because you're getting a gift in kind of some sort. That's there's many other questions. That's one of the more prominent ones. I think the important thing to keep in mind here is not that the Rolling Jubilee is going to relieve in a broad-based way Americans of their debt. But what I think it's going to do is begin or to continue this process of people reexamining debt and their relationship to the debtors. I mean, you know, it is there is a sort of like there's the same quality. And it was Lawyer Matthew, I should say. I didn't want to tell David Graeber this, but it was Lawyer Matthew who sent me that email. Now, members are quite aware of who Lawyer Matthew is, who sent me that email when I was asking him about this, whose reaction to debt was like most of ours. And there's the same quality that we have to debt. Lawyer Matthew is here. He's on the IM. There's the same relationship that we have to debt in the same way that, like, back in the Middle Ages, you know, the peasants had to the kings. You know, it's like divine. There's some, like, sort of like it is an a priori relationship. It's not, we don't even question the notion of whether or not debt is, and this type of debt that we find ourselves is legitimate. On some level, it could be argued that people are in debt in many respects. It's a form of blackmail. If you want to survive or have the opportunity for certain things, you got to go into debt for it. Certainly in the case of medical debt, which we know that over 50% of bankruptcies are a function of that. You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to walk out of the hospital? Are you going to take your child out of the hospital? Because you're not going to be able to pay this and you know you're not going to be able to pay it? I mean, that would be theoretically the moral thing to do, right? And so I think, you know, the best thing about this Rolling Jubilee, aside from for those people who are lucky enough to have their debt bought, and apparently they're starting exclusively with medical debt, is that it will cause a reexamination. I mean, we're just at the beginning of this, folks. We are just at the beginning of this. And look, you know, the responsible people in Washington will say that the idea of perceiving debt as illegitimate, as breaking your promise to pay your credit card company that is charging you 20-25% interest, is the most wretched thing you do. And incidentally, we're so responsible that we're going to cut your cost of living increases in Social Security in the future. That promise we can break. We're going to bail out the bondholders for General Motors, but that promise for your pension and your health care to the unions, that we can break. We know that we have given promises to union members who work for municipal governments about their pension, but that one we can break. That's not a debt that we owe. I mean, so, you know, contemplate this. Why are there two sets of rules for promises and debts. And on that note, folks, I don't want you to go into debt to become a member of the Majority Report. However, if you are one of those people who don't have to go into debt, I mean, ask yourself, do we really have to get to the brink of our own show's financial bankruptcy for you to decide that it's time to become a member? You've been listening to the show now 4 months, some cases for years. And if you can afford to pay for the show, and you contemplate the whatever, $100 a month you pay for cable, I mean, do you really listen or watch? Well, maybe you do watch. I don't know how much cable you watch, but if you watch, let's say, 10 hours a week, 40 hours a month, do you listen to 40 hours of programming from the show? Or do you listen to 4 hours of programming? That would be commensurate, right? 10%? Well, the point is, please, if you can become a member, become a member. I don't know. I can't. I have to come up with all these convoluted ways of asking. You can also support the show by today, the last day, I believe, or tomorrow is the last day of voting for us at podcastawards.com. Very simple. Vote for us for People's Choice and News and Politics. They'll send you an email to confirm. You can do it today, Wednesday, and tomorrow, Thursday, and then the voting's over. And then if we lose, I'm going to be depressed. And I don't think you would like me if I was depressed or more depressed. Let's put it that way. You can also support the show by buying your Amazon junk at our link at majority.fm. Support the show. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, and Chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY. Don't forget that coupon code MAJORITY should work at Bandcamp.com when you buy that Decomposure album from Eating Chicken Records. See you in the better half, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM.